Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Wednesday, August the 28th, 2024, and we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We would like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast. Later on in our program, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the recent siege on the northern West Bank in Palestine by the Israeli occupation forces. The Republic of Namibia in southern Africa has blocked a vessel from its port due to concerns over violations of international law by the State of Israel. A Tanzanian has been appointed as the World Health Organization Director for the Africa region. And Ethiopia is concerned over a military package delivered to Somalia by Egypt. In the second and third hours, we look back on the counterintelligence program against African Americans and their liberation movement as part of our Black August commemoration. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take our musical interlude with the TPOK Jazz Orchestra from an album released in 1969. Let's listen in to this classic African music.
Marcelina, na emi kena kosa kio, bobo ya mobali na yo, na emi kena panza kio sangoe, boko tananza konangae, nikambo moko na bosa na kiko ebisa yo, gai na zalaka na moninga, na koka kite kombo ya yeli boso, kosi mana kende na yo. Ako tunanga ibolingo yanga na yeo na koloba ninye Ako ebisanga maloba na lobaka na yeo na tango tubandaki
Motonyoso asala kama bema mbeku Sokilo kutate na zonde ngini
Marcelina, naemi kena kosa kio, bobo ya mobali na yo, naemi kena panza ki, boko tananza konangai, nikambo moko na bosa na kiko ebisa yo, kai nazala kana moninga, nako kakite kobo ya yeli boso, posi mana kende na yo, ako tunanga ibo. Yanga na yeo na koloba ninye ako ebisanga maloba na lobaka na yeo na tango tubandaki oh Marcelina na emika na kosa kio Marcelina na emika na sana kio kontre ton oko kiko limbisanga Marcelina Marcelina vovo Marcelina, vovo, oh Marcelina, zonga na mobali na yo, malembe, ako kikombo ya yote, Marcelina, je di kutwa tuna kinga ina kafeli yo, so kikombo ya na. Marcelina, vovo, Marcelina, vovo, oh Marcelina, Mbali na yo aligi, bonzonga, bavoya jolinga kai, bongo sala, bongo na yo ezali, Marcelina, bomelanga ese bolingoe. Marcelina, bobo, Marcelina, bobo, oh Marcelina, Mbali na yo abonde lingai minge, alobi nangai boye, Marcelina, kitoko na yo esila kate Marcelina, ma bêtise o salaki Marcelina, abdi a posana. Marcelina bobo, Marcelina bobo. La mama e bongi boyo kani ye 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 nakati andako oko bombela nganganga na motema umado ikambo nini ya mame na salio na senga pago yo ninga bango to ningi senga motema na yo moko epona e Nyonso basana kao na bolingo benemi bazanga kate bako sana nyonso poto kabwana conscience na yo pesa na songi songi poko kaka te kolibi samoni nganzambe soki oyo kili kambo kaka osilika kaka opaso kao dimato alibala mama Boyo kani ye 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 nakati andako oko bombela ngakanda na motema umado ikambo nini ya mame na salio na senga pango yo linga bango to ningi senga motema na yo moko epona e. Na libala nyoso basana kao, abolindo bene mi bazanga kate. Bakosala nyoso mpoto kabwana, mashose na yo pesa na songi songi. Bakata kate kolibi samoni kanzambe, soki yo yo kili kambo kaka osilika.
Thank you.
kiki toko na banga kako ebisa Selina o Selina o Selina o Selina o na banga kako la kisala mulwe sele sele o bomberanga ye bomberanga bolingo ni wali komelinga ipene motema nanga mokulu kaitika Ore kiki toko na banga kako ebisa Selina o, Selina o Selina o, Selina o Na banga kako la kisara mulwe Sele, sele o Selina o, Selina nalinga Selina o, Selina yeye o
Kaputu na pekolula o, batyo simbangami Motema eko tinda unaponise yo
Selina, Selina nalinga Selina,
Selina yeye
o
Obota mana shose o kito peleka yo Nako banga komi pesa unoki ojo wenga ye
Selina, Selina nalinga Selina,
Selina yeye
o
Na pesi yo motema
Selina, Selina, yeah, yeah, oh.
mibale na mibale o soki bino boyokani ye ata libala ya makango ndenge moko na ya makwela na mokili mibale na mibale o soki bino boyokani ye ata libala ya makango ndenge moko na ya makwela. Soki bino boyokani ye ata libala ya makango ndenge moko na ya makwela na mokili mibale na mibale soki bino boyokani ye ata libala ya makango ndenge moko na ya makwela lokumu ya mwasi mpo na mobali ema lokomo ya mwasi mpo na mobali ema yo 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 atosoma yo 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 atosoma. Lokomo mobali mpo na mosaleta lokomo mobali mpo na mosaleta. Yeah, 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 Koinga kana tunate ni kambo palo baka nangai Suwele kayo eme Nakomi tunakao Kibanda kaboni yae Koinga kakoyo kate ni kambo Soki basololi nakombo nangai Esala kayo pasiro Moba botela ngayo e Yangaite, sokina lobili kambona no yokaka Ba promesa na yo, ene kimi bali nyoso, pona zela kayo Yoko banga ngaite, vende toloko nangai, na zela kayo Okobo yangaite, sokina lobili kambona no yokaka Ba promesa na yo ingande na nye fafie bandeko Fatue fafie boli Tomali bondo e sheri yoka mawa Fatue fafie yoka makamu Tepiano motema mozo kie bolingo Sala loko la ozonga e bandeko Fatue
Bala mama, eli bongi boyo kani ye ye ye, nakati andato. Boso bomela nakanda na motema omato. Ikambo nini amabena sali yo natenga papo. Yo linga bango to linki sengai, motema na yo moko eponae. Nali bala yoso baso na kao Na bolingo bene mi bazanga kate Bako sala yoso mpo toka buwana Konsyonswe na yo pesa na songi songi Oko kakate kolibi sa moninga nzambe Soki yoyo kilika mbo kakao silika Kakao pasuka oji mado
boyokani ye 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 na kati andako oko bombela na kanda na motema o mato dikambo nini ya mabena sali yo na senga pardon yo linga bango to lingi sengai motema na yo moko eponae
kabi motema na satana maele o maele na nimi bate kisanga na zando ko boya yo mama na komeka e maele o soki na tuni o yangani lelo na kangi yo na mokanda na kati ya sutia mwae ya koyanga na teo na monika kato boya na olongo linga posa ya kolinga maele Maeko kakazu ateo Eko tindanga na salari boma Maeleo ngaina linga kaloko la soba Na boya kakutu familia luba Hello baby see Ko boya yo mama na komeka
Welcome back, and you're listening to the African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for this Wednesday, August the 28th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. That was the music of the TPOK Jazz Orchestra, led by Francois Luamo, and that was music recorded in 1969. We'll take a break with our Pan-African Newswire segment. And these are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. As such, it was necessary to engage authorities in Namibia on issues of concern to ensure our decisions and actions domestically are aligned with our obligations in terms of international law and our policy stance of many years on Palestine. Now, that was a quote from the Namibian Minister of Justice, Yvonne Dausab. Namibia has blocked a vessel carrying military cargo destined for Israel from docking at one of its ports, citing its obligation not to support or be complicit in Israeli war crimes. Yes, I have asked Namport, the Namibian Sports Authority, via the line of the Line Ministry to consider the request to not allow the vessel MV Catherine to dock in our ports, the Justice Minister Yvonne Dausab told the state newspaper New Era, adding that the request was made on Friday. Dausab said that her position meant she was responsible for ensuring that Namibia complied with its obligations under international law, specifically the Genocide Convention to which Namibia was a party. As such, it was necessary to engage authorities in Namibia on issues of concern to ensure our decisions and actions domestically are aligned with our obligations in terms of international law and our policy stance many years on behalf of the Palestinian people. And in other news taking place in the northern West Bank, the resistance continues to engage in fierce confrontations and carry out operations against the occupation forces, vehicles, and soldiers, achieving confirmed hits in response to the widespread Israeli occupation aggression. Palestinian resistance in the northern occupied West Bank region is continuing to confront the extensive aggression by the Israeli occupation forces. According to Al Mahadin's correspondent in the West Bank, the Israeli occupation forces stormed the town of Anabda, east of Tokram, where the occupation forces deployed additional military reinforcements entering through the northern axis of Tokram towards the Nur Shams camp. In turn, field sources in the West Bank reported renewed confrontations between the resistance freedom fighters and the Israeli occupation forces in the Farah camp south of Tubas, a region located north of the West Bank. Covering the aggression in the Farah camp, Al Mahadin's correspondent reported that the resistance detonated explosive devices against the occupation forces storming the camp. Additionally, our correspondent confirmed that the Israeli occupation forces violently stormed the homes of Palestinians in the Farah camp and bulldozed the camp's roads, destroying the infrastructure and what has become a regular practice for the Israeli occupation. In Tokham, the Palestinian resistance confronted the invading occupation forces aggressing against the Nur Shams camp, our correspondent further reported. In Kalkia, Al-Mahdin's correspondent reported a wide-scale detention campaign against Palestinians in the city. You can read this article in its entirety over the Pan-African News Wire. And you're listening to the Pan-African News Wire segment of the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. And in other news taking place throughout the world, in the East African state of Tanzania, Dr. Faustine Nduguilele of Tanzania was elected as the World Health Organization Regional Director for Africa. This took place yesterday at the ongoing session of the World Health Organization Regional Committee for Africa in Congo-Brazzaville. He received 25 out of the 46 votes, defeating candidates from Rwanda, Niger, and Senegal. He was supported by 25 African countries, including Kenya. A former deputy minister of health in Tanzania, Ndu Gweli, will succeed Masadiso Rebecca Mwete of Botswana, whose 2 5-year terms end at the session. Dr. Ndu Lile, a medical doctor specializing in microbiology, has extensive experience in public health. In his campaigns for the position, he said his priorities include transforming African health systems to achieve universal health coverage, improving maternal and child health, and strengthening health security innovation as well as research. And finally, Ethiopia earlier today responded angrily to Egypt's delivery of arms to Somalia, likely signaling escalated tensions between the two Horn of Africa neighbors. Addis Ababa warned that Somalia's dalliance with external forces was likely to destabilize the region, arguing that the changeover is fraught with danger. The statement from Addis Ababa did not mention Egypt directly, but did say the transition in Somalia from the African Union mission in Somalia to the African Union Support and Stabilization Mission in Somalia was being conducted without regard to the region's security interests. All those responsible for preparing and authorizing a new support mission must take into account the legitimate concerns of countries of the region and the TCC's troop-contributing countries' forces trying to inflame tension for their short-term objectives must shoulder the grave ramifications, Ethiopia's Minister of Foreign Affairs said earlier today. Ethiopia cannot tolerate these actions that endanger the gains made against regional and international terrorist groups. Ethiopia has been a troop contributor to the African Union transitional mission in Somalia, but Somalia has made it clear it won't be a part of the AUSSOM after the two countries differed on the memorandum of understanding Addis Ababa signed with Somalia's breakaway region of Somaliland. Mogadishu protested bitterly, although the two sides recently met twice in Turkey for talks. They failed to resolve the issue. With that, we'll conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998, and since then it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast, just go to the Pan-African Radio Network. You can reach the Pan-African Radio Network at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break and we'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this. The music from the first album of Earth, Wind, and Fire, Love is Life. And you're listening to the Patton African Journal, a special worldwide radio broadcast for this Wednesday, August the 28th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit, and we're going to go back into our Black August commemorations. We have a focus today on the impact of the FBI's counterintelligence program against the African-American liberation struggle. Let's listen in to this report.
As far back as the 1920s, when he began as FBI director, Hoover had gone after persons like Marcus Garvey. Garvey's organization, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, had a membership numbering in the millions, and somehow Hoover found this threatening and worthy of surveillance and undermining attempts. Garvey's influence had been international and had drawn world attention to America's treatment of black people. Paul Robeson was another who was viewed by Hoover as an enemy. This reporter has personally examined thousands of FBI, CIA, and other U.S. government agency documents that were kept on Paul Robeson. Robeson, like Garvey, had an international audience at his command, and he used that platform to denounce racism in the United States.
Most importantly, however, were the questions raised by the State Department as to my political opinion. Here's a question of whether one who wants to sing and act can have, as a citizen, political opinion. And in attacking me, they suggested that when I was abroad, I spoke out against injustices to the Negro people in the United States. I certainly did. And the Supreme Court Justice just ruled, Judge Warren, in the segregation cases, that world opinion had a lot to do with that ruling, that our children, Negro children, can go to school like anybody else in the South. I'm very proud to have been a part of directing world opinion to precisely that condition. The second, that I fight for the independence of the colonial peoples of Africa. Bandung, the colored peoples of the world assembled, made it clear that nobody is going to tell them what to do. They're going to have the independence. I'm proud of that.
When the 60s came, many factions of the civil rights movement had developed the same international perspective.
Those of us living in the United States who see ourselves as, and who are in fact, you know, descendants of the Africans who were brought to this country, who were enslaved, I mean, and who are rebelling and revolting now against our oppressive condition, and we are concerned about Africa. We see Africa as our motherland, and we feel that we have a responsibility to speak with as much passion as any other African on this issue. The United States government says that change must come in South Africa through peaceful means. That same government has over 500,000 troops in Vietnam fighting not white people, but brown Vietnamese.
So it is small wonder that the civil rights movement was also subjected to heavy attacks by Hoover. Billions of government dollars were spent in this direction. Many of these activities were not only unwarranted, but of questionable legality. The congressional hearings into the assassination of Dr. King bore this out. Two FBI agents testified before a Senate committee chaired by Senator Frank Church.
I'm trying to find out what it was that impelled some part of the FBI to pursue Martin Luther King with such an obsession. And what I understood that answer to be is, first of all, it was not any suspicions of the commission of a federal crime. None of the literature showed up a single suggestion that Martin Luther King had committed or was about to commit a crime. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But at this point, much of what was being done did involve challenges to local laws. And there is a very strong suggestion that King was seen as rallying the lawbreakers and would-be lawbreakers, albeit for a cause that sounded pure. Looking now in terms of, if we look at what might have gotten the Bureau started, if we remember at the same time he is extremely critical of the Bureau's own law enforcement efforts, we see throughout these documents and the New Left documents that it is taboo to criticize the Bureau and particularly the director.
Well, was he ever charged with fomenting violence? Did he ever participate in violence? Was it ever alleged that he was about to be violent?
That was the very opposite of his philosophy, Senator.
So that it was neither the fear of commission of a crime or the commission of violence. Was there any serious charge that he himself was a communist?
No such charge ever was made.
So that what was left then was a decision on the part of some persons or person within the FBI that he should nevertheless be pursued.
And replaced.
And the basis for that apparently was political. The decision that he was dangerous or potentially dangerous to someone's notion of what this country should be doing, and a further theory that the FBI possessed the ability to enter into this field and to investigate and to intimidate and seek to neutralize and indeed replace a civil rights leader that they thought to be politically unacceptable. Is that correct?
Yes.
Correct.
All right. And the tactics they used apparently had no end. Microphonic surveillance of hotel rooms. They included informants. They included sponsoring of letters signed by phony names to relatives and friends and organizers. They involved even plans to replace him with someone else the FBI was to select as a national civil rights leader. Is that correct?
Yes, that plan didn't get very far.
But it was seriously considered, and Mr. Hoover penned a note to that suggestion commending its authors, did they not?
Yes.
Right. It also included an indirect attempt to persuade the Pope not to see him.
And many other people.
A direct attempt to persuade one of our major universities not to grant him a doctorate degree.
That's correct. After the March on Washington, there was an acceleration. He was defined because of his speech in that demonstration in Washington as the most dangerous and effective leader in the country, and there was a paper battle within the Bureau as to how best to attack him, and he was attacked. After Time magazine named him as Man of the Year, again, the Bureau finds that reprehensible, believes it must attack and destroy. When he was given the Nobel Prize, again, they seek to discredit Dr. King with the persons who welcomed him back from that award. When he began to speak out against the Vietnam War, there's a new crescendo of efforts by the Bureau to discredit and destroy Dr. King.
It is my feeling that the assassination of Dr. King was a part of a conspiracy in the country, and I do believe that some individuals in very high places of our government were involved in this conspiracy. And it is the same conspiracy that eliminated and destroyed President Kennedy, Senator Kennedy, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, and so many other freedom and human rights individuals.
I'm convinced the government was involved at some level. I will never separate the conduct, the attitude of Hoover and the FBI from Dr. King's assassination. I never will do that.
I think one of the most important things that come out in that investigation was that Martin Luther King in Memphis was in a white hotel, and the FBI admitted that they leaked to the press that Dr. King was staying in a white hotel instead of a black hotel, and it was that embarrassment that forced Dr. King to move into the Lorraine Hotel where he was killed.
There are more questions regarding the FBI's role in the assassination of Dr. King. For example, why was Dr. King stripped of his protection just before he was killed in Memphis? Reporter Les Payne and myself interviewed police officer Ed Reddit of the Memphis Police Department, who told how he was mysteriously removed from his security post near Dr. King. However, later, his superior, Chief Holloman, denied doing so.
Why do you feel you were pulled away from your assignment of surveillance that day? Why do you think they pulled you away?
I think because
whoever pulled the trigger, I could identify.
When there were complaints from somebody, did we reduce manpower at the Lorraine? Did we reduce manpower in
no.
the area?
No.
The attorneys general in 1965 had for 25 years authorized wiretaps in a fairly widespread fashion. This was just one. At the very most, the only thing I can think of that I would have done, but I didn't even do that, was go talk to Bob Kennedy and ask him about it. But Mr. Katzenbach, in whom I also had great confidence, without giving me the details, said that it was all right, that he had, that there were no, it was not being done anymore, it would not be done anymore, and that there's just nothing to worry about.
I think the issue is the neo-fascist police state mentality that pervaded the intelligence community, that is a danger to America to this day.
Malcolm X was kept under heavy FBI surveillance since he got out of prison back in 1953. As he rose to national prominence as the black Muslims' chief spokesman, he became aware that he was under close watch.
Our desire, our prayer, that we can have a peaceful, intelligent rally here this afternoon. But at the same time, we see that they have surrounded us with many of their own agents in uniform and out of uniform.
That surveillance escalated into the infiltration of the Nation of Islam. Personal frailties were played upon. Jealousy arose. And Malcolm was ultimately ousted from that organization. This caused an intense climate of rivalry that set the stage for Malcolm's assassination in February of 1965.
He was really declared a hypocrite at the time. And because of some of the things that he was saying in regards to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, may God be pleased with him, a strong position was really taken against him. The ministers began to speak out against the things that Malcolm was saying in regards to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, accusations that he had made about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He had accused the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, for instance, of fathering children and et cetera. And you must understand that at that time, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, to the Muslims then, was held in such high reverence as you would even think of any prophet being held in high reverence. And this is the kind of love and admiration that the Muslims at that time had for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So when Minister Malcolm began to say those things, it was taken as an outright lie. I would say that, take for instance, one time in the Muhammad Speaks at that time, the newspaper printed a big article concerning the chief hypocrite. And it actually had a picture of Malcolm's head, you know, rolling or bouncing down the street at that time. And, you know, the way that picture is depicted, you know, he has little horns on his head and things like this here. So indirectly, I would say that a very, very strong position was taken against him.
Yes, he's immoral. You can't take nine teenage women and seduce them and give them babies, and not tell me you're moral. You could do it if you admitted you did it, and admitted that the babies were yours. I'd shake your hand and call you a man, a good one too. But anytime you seduce teenage girls and make them be charged with adultery, make them hide your crime, why, you're not even a man, much less a divine man. So. And this is what he did. He took at least nine that we know about. And I'm not speculating, because he told this to me himself. Yes, that's why he wanted me dead, because he knew that as soon as I woke up, I'd tell it.
Plan of action was basically what took place. Me and Leon, we took seats down in the front of the Audubon, became early. We would drift into the Audubon. If indeed there was a search, then we could never enter. There was no search, so we drifted in just like we had hoped to. Leon Davis and myself took seats down front on the left-hand side. Benjamin and William, who carried the sort of shotgun, sat right behind us, you know. And Wilbur sat somewhat in the back or almost in the middle. And our plan was, as soon as brother came out to speak, that Wilbur would throw the smoke bomb to make a distraction, and that William would fire his shotgun, and that Leon and myself, we would fire our weapons, and then just break for the door.
And what I did is that was, I bring before you as one of the mountains, and I pray that you and I will listen, hear, and understand. Thank you.
As in Dr. King's assassination, a police superior has trouble with the truth. He tells reporters that two suspects were arrested at the Audubon. Later, official police reports say that one was arrested. Also, listen closely as the police official carefully handles the question about police on the scene.
We have two suspects in custody now.
Where were they arrested? Who fired the shot?
I wouldn't know that at this time.
Where were they arrested, sir?
One of these men was arrested on the street by one of our patrolmen close by.
There were no police at this meeting, were there, Inspector?
There were no uniformed policemen assigned inside this ballroom.
No uniform police on the scene. Does this mean that police out of uniform were there? And if so, why didn't they take action? What were they doing there? This behavior pattern rings a bell of striking similarity with the behavior pattern of the CIA overseas.
The church committee produced cables, demanded and got cables, which proved it traced the CIA's plan to kill Lumumba. Sid Gottlieb got on a plane and went to Leopoldville. Headquarters sent a cable saying, use the poison. Gottlieb was couriering for the poison. Headquarters sent a cable saying, you have to use it promptly because it deteriorates. And they had a plan to try and get it into his toothpaste or give it to him in a Mickey at some social function. And then there's a gap, and no cables, no explanation of what happened. Then 5 weeks later, he's beaten to death on an airplane. And unfortunately, though, the airplane was in the control of people who had agency cryptonyms. And the gap of what happened has never been answered. The men who were involved and were responsible obviously aren't speaking out, and there's no paper to prove anything.
So perhaps the same tactics were used against the civil rights movement. Heavy infiltration of the ranks, spread the seeds of dissension, then step back and let the blood spill.
As I see it, Mr. Chairman, it is for this committee to be able to figure out how to persuade the people of this country that indeed it did go on. And how shall we ensure that it never happened again? But it will happen repeatedly unless we can bring ourselves to understand and accept that it did go on. And I say that as one who worked as a United States attorney with the Bureau and have enormous respect for its capacities in the field of kidnapping, bank robbery, and a lot of other things, but am appalled to learn what the, if it's correct, the intelligence side of that Bureau was up to for so long.
If we would like to believe that the FBI would do all this viciousness and all of these things to an individual and would stop short of killing him, then we're out of our mind. In America today, if we believe the CIA would deal with foreign assassinations and would not consider that home, that's like saying the mafia runs crooked gambling tables in South America, but honest ones in America. It just ain't true.
We've seen then how the decade of struggle ended. Many of the prominent figures like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. were assassinated amidst an intense climate of hatred that government agencies were acutely aware of. In fact, the FBI contributed to creating the climate of hate. Moreover, the assassinations themselves appear to have been facilitated by an elaborate network of government and police agencies who were watching very closely every move that Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. were making, and then at the same time, they disappeared just as the assassinations occurred. But those were the leaders. What about the students, the troops of the movement? Well, they too were subjected to harassment. This document that you're looking at now shows how the FBI tried to divide factions within the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And the Black Panther Party was also subjected to heavy, heavy surveillance.
We knew the history of the FBI's infiltration tactics in other organizations, particularly the American Communist Party. There was already a record compiled that showed that the FBI was even in charge of various branches of the Communist Party. So we understood that police tactic of infiltration. There was a situation where, in a sense, the white racism was its own victim. Like, for racist reasons, J. Edgar Hoover had not recruited black agents. He had a lot of white agents. And it takes time to train some black agents. In the meantime, those white agents, try as they might, were not able to infiltrate our ranks because the Black Panther Party did not have any white members, okay? And we relied upon people that we knew. And we kept people that we didn't know on another level. And I think this is why we didn't suffer more that way, because they did catch up and start a crash program of recruiting black agents, and they very quickly filled that gap, but it took them about a year to do it.
In the summer of 1978, I interviewed a man who worked as an informer for the FBI during the 1960s. His name is Dothard Perry, also known as Ed Riggs, also known as Bill Perry, also known as Othello.
How were you paid?
The pay was always in cash. Cash, and you would sign a card. It would go like this. A rendezvous or a drop-off point would be picked out either by yourself or the agent. You would meet the agent there. Usually it would be in a vehicle. You get in the vehicle, he would hand you the money. He would tell you first to count the money. He would tell you the amount while you counted it. If the amount was there, he would then bring out a card. On that card would be for the week of such and such, in other words, the week was dated, so-and-so has been paid the amount of. Then you would sign the card, and then the agent would sign the card. The reason for this is that if all of a sudden the IRS became very interested about where you were getting all this extra money from, you could always tell them to go back to the Bureau, and the Bureau would have your cards on file.
I see. Were there such things as bonuses?
Oh, yes.
What were they paid for?
Bonuses were paid for, suppose while you were meeting with, or you were at a meeting with Bobby Seals, Chulai of the Red Army happened to come to the meeting too, which is something which would be a new development. That's bonus time.
In other words, a hot piece of information.
Hot piece, very hot piece.
Did you ever suffer pangs of conscience?
Quite a few times. Quite a few times. I still suffer pains of conscience. I suffer from the fact that a lot of people trusted me, and I misused that trust. I suffer from the fact that a lot of information that I gave out was the undoing of certain groups or certain people. I suffer from the fact that I'm on the run constantly. I have no real life to speak of.
You have no family life, really? You have a wife?
No, I don't have a wife. I do have a child. I can't see her that often. I have to stay away from them because once I come around, the Bureau shows up and harassment starts. I have very few close personal friends, no one to really confide in. It's like being on the outside of a glass jar and everything is happening inside the jar, but you're on the outside. You can see it happening, but you can't participate.
Why have you decided to talk to me?
For the simple reason, I think this information should be put out to the public. I think not only black people, but everyone should become aware of what your so-called law enforcement agencies do to so-called enforce the law. Because between you, myself, and the audience, I've seen more felons in law enforcement than I have in prison.
Many would say, well, look, you yourself just got through saying that the DLA was involved in criminal activity. What's wrong with wanting to put them in prison? How would you answer them?
I would answer them in this way. First off, we have to understand why they did what they did. But I'm not even going to go off into that psychological hoo-ha. What I'm going to say is when you become just as bad as the people that you go after, then there's nothing gained and a whole lot lost.
You also were active in the infiltration of many cultural groups. Before we go into that step by step, how much research and study did the FBI engage in of black culture in the late 60s?
A great amount.
Give me an idea.
From the thing is, they have a file on every type of magazine that blacks read. They have a file on the music.
Music?
Music, dance, theater, actors, comedians, you name it, man.
And they would actually study these
different... Oh, yes, definitely.
What would they do with music?
To understand the people, you have to understand the culture. To infiltrate, you have to understand. You had a lot of so-called white liberals that were infiltrating the so-called black groups using the information that they had gathered from the studies of blacks.
You mean just to understand the behavior pattern of our people?
Oh, yeah. I can, Will Heaton could name out some jams of Miles Davis that I hadn't even heard of. He could name off some books that I hadn't even read pertaining to black culture.
Do you ever see agents actually studying music of...
Yes. I've seen them going over even video portion of cultural events. The understanding, like when, you have an organization like Leroy Jones Black House. You remember that. Okay, Leroy Jones's place, which was done on the thing of tribalism. That's where I first heard the word Kintu, Mantu, Huntu, Hintu, these words of the African continuum. I learned that from an agent. He ran it down to me. they make in-depth studies of the personalities of the people they're dealing with, too, culturally. It always helps. It's a thing of you can take their culture and use it against them.
How large would you say an extensive a collection on our culture would you say the FBI has? Would you rate it as large as a particular library, like the Schomburg Library in Harlem?
I would rate it better. I would rate it better, and the fact is that they go into details that we probably would overlook. Will Heaton used to meet me in different places. You know, Will Heaton, that was one of my supervising agents. There is a certain bar in the Los Angeles area where people into black cultural things met, and Will Heaton used to meet me there. And he would go into very long and tiring conversations with some very articulate brothers about culture, African culture, and Afro-American culture.
Tell me about some of the cultural organizations that you infiltrated and what you did.
PASLA, Mafunde, Watts Writers Workshop, which they had.
Watts Writers Workshop?
Yes. Watts Writers Workshop, which was one of the oldest established black writers' workshop.
That place was burned down.
Yeah. The bureau had it burned down.
How do you know that?
I know because I participated. I did the arson.
You burned down the Watts Writers'
workshop? Yes.
Why did they want it to go?
At the time, funding had been cut to the workshop, had been cut out, but it looked like there was a possibility of a grant being given back to the workshop. And if there was no theater, there would be no grant.
How did you do it?
Two cans of kerosene, a Purex bottle, gasoline, and a flare, highway flare.
Why didn't you use more sophisticated stuff?
Oh, no. No. You never overly sophisticated. It's too obvious. This way you make it look like, maybe somebody in the neighborhood that got kicked out of theater at one time got mad and came and burned the damn theater up, that kind of thing.
But you were involved in this theater? I mean, didn't it get to you at all what you were...
Hey, man, that got to me a great deal. I love that theater. I built the stage.
You built the stage?
Oh, yeah. When I got to the workshop, the stage... that had been the original stage that had been built needed an extension on it. The original part of the stage was in terrible condition. They had no lighting system. I put the lighting system in myself. I put the stage in myself. And that was a stage, man. And that was a theater. It's a nice theater.
Who was the director of that workshop?
Harry Dolan.
Harry Dolan. Some very, very well-known artists supported that workshop, gave money to it.
Some very well-known artists came out of the Watts Writers Workshop. You know, Glenn Tubman, Yaphet Kotto, Sidney Poitier used to come down there and give a class. Sammy Davis Jr. used to come down there all the time. Quincy Jones used to come there and give music classes. We had our own 8-track studio set up for sound. We had our own sound room there.
Was part of your other activities and responsibilities to study the profiles of celebrities who were supportive of organizations?
Definitely, and especially, like I said, psychological backgrounds, weaknesses, and strengths. Did he have a weakness for blondes? Did he have a weakness for money? Did he snort cocaine? Did he smoke marijuana? They even get into, that's one thing the Bureau loves, is their sexual background. They have files and files on different blacks, not only celebrities, but a lot of others, sexual activity.
What would they do with this information?
Oh, that's used as a weakness.
So they would feed these to these weaknesses?
Yes.
Did you see that happen?
Oh, yes. Doc Holliday, who is one of the leaders of the BGF, Black Gorilla Family, which is a prison gang in the California state prison system. Upon his release from prison, a certain sister made herself known to him at a nightclub, whereupon he moved in with her, and she picked up names, telephone numbers, information, you know, that kind of thing. That lasted for a good 3.5 months.
Was this an unusual thing, or did this happen often?
No, that happens all the time.
Did you yourself get involved in doing that?
Yes.
Give me an example.
There was a gentleman that was on trial in Los Angeles that belonged to the BLA that had been busted in a southern state for a bank robbery, but was brought with two other people to Los Angeles to stand trial for the machine gunning of a police officer in Los Angeles. I was supposed to worm my way into the affections of his sister and whatever it took to get the information that I needed as far as what kind of defense they planned to use as to turn this information over to the federal prosecution.
Did you do it?
I got the information, and thank God I didn't have to go through with the actual thing of sexual activity.
What do you mean, thank God?
The sister was rather unappealing.
How did you justify to the organizations in which you had infiltrated yourself that you were living on an $800 a week stipend or on an $800 a week standard of living when most of them were living hand to mouth?
Well, hey, brother, you know, I'm hustling, you know. I mean, hey, man, you know, sell a little of this on the side, a little of that on the side. You know, I get over, you know, that kind of thing. In other words, ain't nobody's business but mine where I get the money. So, you know, everybody took it for granted that I was possibly doing a little dealing on the side, that kind of thing. Then also, everybody liked me for the simple reason that I would do things that I didn't have to do. I would go out of my way. You know, like Mafundi would have a pageant and they needed someone to do the sound setup for him. And I'd say, of course, I'll do it for you. You know, that kind of thing. I was very well liked at one time in the community.
Would you say to American citizens that this situation of surveillance and infiltration continues to this day?
Oh, yes.
On the dimension that you experienced?
Probably much larger by now.
Larger?
Oh, yeah. Let me put it to you like this. Each year, everything gradually escalated up more and more. So I figure when I left, it didn't stop escalating. As they say, one monkey does not stop anybody's show.
You mentioned Sammy Davis Jr., who at one time, it was reported, gave money to the Black Panther Party, I believe. Were you ever assigned to look into that?
Yes, I was told to try to get as close to Mr. Davis or to anyone in his office as I could. I used to go up and have real chit-chat, chummy-chummy conversation with his personal secretary, Ann, at the 9000 building on Sunset. And I used to bring a Porter-Pack video camera, and I used to go around and I would videotape the whole office.
You mean celebrities would be coming into his office and you'd film them freely?
Oh, yeah.
Didn't they question that?
I'm from the Ross Writers Workshop. Yeah, right on, brother, you know, that kind of thing. No questions asked. Same thing with the NAACP Image Awards, you know. They were very interested in people like Sammy Davis Jr. There was another black in Los Angeles that they were very interested in because, not Los Angeles, but in Sacramento, Nathaniel Colley, who's attorney for the NAACP. And I know Nat. and they wanted information on him just for the simple reason that he's an attorney for the NAACP, which makes no sense to me, but must make a lot of sense to them because they use the information.
You've been called upon to testify in Washington. Before who?
Before the Senate committee. I was called first to testify before the church committee, and I did go to Washington, D.C. I did testify to those people, and I want to say right now that the committee was full of smacks. They got loads and loads of information and didn't even use it, didn't release it. I had tapes that I offered to them in evidence against the Federal Bureau of Investigation with conversations of me and my supervising officer where he's telling me to obtain certain articles for him by stealing. Don't get fingerprints on it. We can really use that. Did you take the weapons over to such and such? The Church's committee told me that they couldn't use the tapes because the tapes were gotten by illegal means.
What would you say about the composition of the committee panel that questioned you?
I can say that's for the birds, too, because the same people that I was talking about were the same people on the panel with the Church's committee.
What do you mean?
When I came in the room to be interviewed by the so-called people from the Church's committee, the representatives from the Federal Bureau of Investigation were also in the room.
FBI agents were a member of the Church committee panel?
They were there with the investigators for the Church's committee asking questions just like the Church's committee. And see, this is another thing that I find fault with, and this is another reason why I am not going to Washington, D.C., is that, again, I have been asked to come again for the second time. I'm not going again for the simple reason that when I went up there, with the idea that there were agencies investigating the Federal Bureau of Investigation, not the Federal Bureau of Investigation investigating itself.
You're on the lam, almost. Do you have a sense that you're going to be arrested and go to prison?
Oh, yeah, eventually. Eventually, when things come to a head, it has to. Has to be that way. No other way around it.
What would you say to citizens who sit and listen to what you've said and have a sense of frustration and helplessness?
There are some agents, the old line agents, that disagree with the tactics that were used during the so-called COINTEL period. But one thing I don't want us to jump off of is that people always talk about, they're talking about COINTEL now so heavily. I'm not talking about COINTEL. I'm talking about a thing called BD, which was better known as Black Desk. The Black Desk was set up for a simple thing of infiltrating black organizations and black groups, whatever.
Where was this Black Desk, or were there a number of them?
There were a number of Black Desks, but the head Black Desk was in Washington, D.C., controlled by Sullivan. And the...
Was he black?
No.
Mm-hmm. And what was the function of the Black Desks all over the country? I guess there were dozens.
The function of the Black Desk was to monitor activity, social unrest, revolutionary groups, cultural groups, and such in the black community.
And feed it into this central desk. And it still exists?
As far as I know, yes.
We've seen a number of investigations into the assassination of Martin Luther King. We've seen an extended police trial of the assassination of Malcolm X. What you seem to say substantiates what many black people say out on the street, that government agents or agencies knew that these assassinations were brewing and either participated in them or allowed them to take place.
It would behoove black people, it would behoove all people, really, to question so-called the cut-and-dry one lone assassin theory. The Bureau and other intelligence agencies are very good at conspiracies. They are very good at setting people up to be killed. They are very good at making innuendos so the person will be killed.
City police don't know about it. because they have policemen in there. They don't let black people form anything without some policemen in there. And while I was in the black Muslim movement, over the black Muslim movement, many of the police who were sent to infiltrate us, they're black, would tell me, say, look, I'm a cop, but I have to come. They would tell me. I knew the Muslim movement was full of police. So don't you think anything is going down that they don't know about. The only thing that goes down is what they want to go down. And what they don't want to go down, they don't let it go down.
Something else was used against the students that drove the final nails into the coffin, killing the movement.
What stopped it, of course, almost dead in its track, and not by any accident, was a widespread and deliberately organized widespread use of drugs. The fact that a decision was made, and I think you, most of you familiar with the broadcast of the mafia defector who went on public media to declare what happened and outline in great detail the great plan of how to destroy the black youth of the nation, starting in New York. He said in a meeting 20 miles outside of New York City, the great decision was made. He said he didn't have to guess about it, and I those who heard him know that I'm quoting him almost verbatim, because he was there. And the decision was to concentrate the distribution of drugs on the black youth of the nation, starting in New York, beginning in the elementary school, and that to punish, even on the pain of death, any of the distributors who invaded the white community or predominantly white schools. That New York and other large cities were to be divided up into districts. The district commander, black, was to be given any kind of car you wanted, Mercedes, Rolls Royce, anything, because this would be a part of the sales pitch. Said blacks just love fine cars, and he'd drive around through the community in his fine car, and some of his key assistants, and he'd be identified, he'd be known, and that sort of stuff. And so I'm not going any farther into it. But thus it began, and the spread over the country. And we fell for it. Now, one thing was important. That the thing to attract the blacks, more than any other thing, more than the drug itself, but to spread the word, have a number of key young people in it, and spread the word that this is the end thing. So that'll get them. Just say it's the end thing. And they'll brave the fires of hell to be a part of the end thing.
So that's our story of the decade of struggle. We put together this film to pay particular homage and tribute to the extraordinary young people of that era. And we give the story to our young people of today in particular, in the hope that they'll stop and think about much of the negativism that they're caught up in nowadays and try to understand why.
I did in the storm so long. I did. been in the storm so long. I've been in the storm so long, children. I've been in the storm.
Welcome back, and that was a news program on the impact, some aspects of the impact of the counterintelligence program on the African-American people and African people throughout the world. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
Hitting wrong notes.
Wow, this old Viola is coming my way. When it's around, I never have a happy day. He gives me back up by rubbing his ring. See that? I just broke a guitar string. Oh.
My door, now my house is burning down. Crackle, crackle.
Wow! Look over yonder, this is the end. He just now said he wants to be my friend. When he's around, I can't do nothing right. He got me wearing shades in the middle of the night. Look over yonder.
The track entitled Look Over Yonder. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Wednesday, August the 28th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'll continue with our focus on Black August. Let's listen in to yet another report. And, of course, the Pan-African Journal can be reached at...
When these efforts started to show a little bit of success, that's when the government moved in.
COINTELPRO was the code word for counterintelligence program, and it was a program that the FBI created in 1956 to go after the Communist Party with intentions of trying to neutralize the party, put it out of business.
In 1967, they start what became known as MH Chaos, a code word for illegal domestic operations within the United States.
We can say that the COINTELPRO was a kind of
codification for white supremacy in America, because the function of the FBI was to preserve white political, social, economic supremacy in America.
Counterintelligence staff under James Angleton was not the only CIA office which was involved in illegal operations within the United States and with the general attempt to get information on the foreign hand in the protest movement. The Office of Security was another major effort by the CIA.
I've seen top secret documents from the White House authored by Nixon communicating with J. Edgar Hoover specifically about the Panthers.
Hoover had, well, if you want to call it an enemy list, had lists, but it's difficult to say what Nixon's men had. They pulled the Watergate, so I guess they could do just about anything.
The Black Panther Party was looked at as the number one threat to the internal security of the United States of America. These are word by word, verbatim quotes from J. Edgar Hoover.
The year of 69, every branch and office of the Black Panther Party in one way, shape, fashion, form, or another was attacked by the power structure, law enforcement agencies, and so on.
There are people walking around out there like walking wounded, you know. It's just like they've been in Vietnam. Victims of gun battles and sieges and isolation and torture and destroyed families and dead parents. And nobody knows about them and nobody really cares. And that story is one that hasn't been told yet.
At the University of California at Los Angeles, two Black Panthers were shot to death during a black students' meeting on the campus last Friday.
Two FBI informants in the United Slaves had shot and killed Bunchy Carter and John Huggins on the UCLA campus.
Us organizations slapped a member of Black Panther Party at the time, Elaine Brown.
Was going with John Huggins, so when she told him that somebody from the US organization had slapped her, he pulled his pistol out. This is when the two brothers, supposedly Steiner brothers, supposedly steps out from behind the doors and open fire and kills John and kills Bunchy.
And the FBI agent who was controlling two informants was concerned that some white students might have been shot on campus.
The members of the US organization were taken from the crime scene with the FBI.
The government or whoever, Power, COINTEL, whatever, they were able to kill a party when they killed Bunchy. When they killed Bunchy, they killed the party. We just didn't know it.
Taken down to the Manhattan District Attorney's office in the wee hours of the morning after having been roused from bed by teams of machine gun toting policemen. Gene Roberts had the dubious distinction of having been Malcolm X's bodyguard when he was assassinated. He was one of the major agents in the Panther 21 case.
They brought us all in, put us in one room. They brought Ralph White Sedan, the other undercover agent, with a sawed-off shotgun, and they brung him in with his head down like he's under arrest, took him in another room, and they had Gene Robbins sitting in another office, sitting down, looking like he was depressed, like he was arrested.
And it was down there that we realized that there were three undercover agents that were actively involved in framing us for the charges for which we were arrested.
After they get the conspiracy charges on you, they let the agents out the side door, and they go back out in the community as nothing's wrong, or they were still Panthers when they wasn't Panthers at all. They were just agents that infiltrated the Black Panther Party.
Most of the Panther 21 spent 2 years in prison after after a trial that lasted 15 months, a jury came back with a not guilty verdict in 45 minutes on all 150 counts of conspiracy. It was a colossal victory to have defeated the state's attempt to criminalize the leadership of the Black Panther Party.
Eldridge Cleaver, the Black Panther leader who fled to Cuba to avoid being returned to jail, arrived in Algeria today to attend a Pan-African cultural festival in Algiers.
FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover today asserted that of the black extremist groups, the Black Panthers represent the greatest internal threat to the nation. In his report for fiscal year 1969, Hoover said the Panthers have perpetrated numerous assaults on police and have engaged in violent confrontations throughout the country.
You might murder a freedom fighter like Bobby Hutton, but you can't murder freedom fighting. And if you do, you come up with answers that don't answer, explanations that don't explain. You come up with conclusions that don't conclude.
Fred Hampton, who, by the way, I would look at as one of the true leaders of the Panthers.
Extraordinarily talented. 21 years old. Articulate. Watch some of his films. Hear him speak. He was a dangerous man. He could persuade people that there was injustice. That the United States ought to be changed.
Black people need some peace. White people need some peace. And we are going to have to fight. We're going to have to struggle. We're going to have to struggle relentlessly to bring about some peace, because the people that we're asking for peace, they're a bunch of megalomaniac warmongers, and they don't even understand what peace means.
He was the heart and soul of the Chicago chapter of the Black Panther Party. And just an awesome motivator.
We hate the oppressor, whether he be white, black, brown, or yellow.
And he began to forge coalitions between various street gangs or youth organizations in Chicago. And by doing that, and by being a charismatic leader and being one who could mobilize the people, particularly the youth, he became noticed by the federal government.
We might not be back. I might be in jail. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary, and you're going to have to keep on saying that.
The FBI never personally killed any Panthers. They always had local police departments do their dirty work, and they began to devise a scheme that culminated in his assassination while he was asleep, drugged by his security officer, who was also a police informant.
City police in Chicago murdered Fred Hampton.
It had happened apparently about 4 o'clock in the morning on December 4th. I didn't hear about it until 6 o'clock that night because I wasn't in town. And they popped this picture up on the screen. Actually, two pictures, one of Fred Hampton and one of Mark Clark. And I was just stunned. I was staring at the screen and I realized I was crying.
They shot that place up in ways you couldn't believe. His wife, pregnant, shot up in the bed there. She survived, as did the fetus, but Fred's body was riddled. The walls of the room, riddled. You could count scores of bullet holes there. He never got out of the bed. He was murdered right there. 2:30 in the morning, they claim they're serving a search warrant. Don't we know anything about human rights? You don't serve a search warrant at 2:30 in the morning. You don't come crashing in with guns blazing and kill people asleep in their beds in the United States of America, or do you?
In essence, was an assassination authorized by the FBI or sanctioned by the FBI.
Planet Square 4148 North St. Andrews, Bellary, not safe.
The criminal conspiracy unit of LAPD, their mission in life was to investigate extremist groups, primarily the Black Panthers. And the FBI had a special unit called the S2 unit. They euphemistically called it their racial squad. Their focus was on the Black Panther Party. So the FBI's racial squad and the LAPD's criminal conspiracy section worked literally hand in hand in bringing down the LA Black Panther Party and its leadership, Pratt in particular.
When Muncie Carter and John Huggins had been assassinated, Pratt became the leader of the Panthers, and now the FBI had to get rid of Pratt.
Geronimo Pratt was a Vietnam veteran. He'd been a paratrooper and won many medals in Vietnam, including a Purple Heart. He trained all the Panthers in Los Angeles on how to defend the office against attack. He was the defense minister, so he was clearly somebody that the FBI was out to neutralize.
December 8, 1969, Los Angeles, Special Weapons and Tactics, Criminal Conspiracy Section, LAPD, FBI.
The Black Panthers, as we all know, were destroyed as an organization through these illegal FBI operations. And certainly the CIA violated the privacy and the rights of thousands upon thousands of Americans through the illegal operations which they agreed to do under Richard Helms as director.
Any and everything was done to members of the Black Panther Party to destroy not only the Black Panther Party and other organizations, but to demoralize people, to discredit us in the eyes of the people, to criminalize our existence in the consciousness and minds of the people.
It's physical violence and torture, per se. There's nothing modern about it, and there is nothing sophisticated or scientific about it. It is the base against which psychological warfare has its meaning.
We went to interview Dr. Mutulu Shakur, who had cured thousands of drug addicts with the experimental treatment of acupuncture. We found him in an underground prison.
The Black Liberation Movement in 1969 lost something like 43 people were killed, and something like 785 people were arrested and put in prison. In any other country with the population that New African people represent, in any other country in the world, that would be considered war.
We went to interview Mumia Abu-Jamal, the Peabody Award-winning journalist. We found him awaiting execution on death row.
In essence, when one looks at the aims and objectives of the federal government through the FBI, by way of the COINTELPRO program, what one really sees is a war against Black America, a war against in the words of the filing fact, the emergence of a Black Messiah who could lead Black America.
In 1970, there were tremendous trials. The United States government began to try to sweep up all of the leftovers of the 60s into these major conspiracies. And they had the Black Panther trial, the Chicago 7 trial, the LA 17 trial, the Wilmington 10 trial, the RNA 11 trial. There was just tons and tons of these types of trials. Many of our people went to the wayside psychologically, emotionally and physically.
15-hour shootouts, Philadelphia, New Orleans, Los Angeles, San Diego, the frame-up of hundreds of Panthers across the country on ridiculous trumped-up charges.
I was arrested. I was 19 years old. We were the first Waco The New African, New Bethel incident, when the police came in, the Detroit police came in there to try to shoot up. Everybody in that church, men, women, and children, were having a peaceful demonstration to try to kill them. They were shooting under the pews. They were shooting the little children running and crying.
There's nothing to me has been more painful out of all the people I know that died in Vietnam than those comrades who died out here in the streets. There is nothing, nothing.
My good friend Julio Rodan of the Young Lords Party was killed in the New York prison called the Tombs.
If they were doing it in Vietnam and it was perfectly legitimate to go out and kill as many Vietnamese as one could, or Viet Cong as one could, then why not kill enemies in the United States?
Today, a judge set Newton free on $50,000 bond to await a new trial.
Newton's last trial and manslaughter conviction were overturned by a higher court this year, so now he'll be tried again. And in the meantime, he is out on bail. He is back on the street. Before Newton got out of prison, the founder of the Black Panther Party sat and talked about his plans for the Panthers now.
I plan to go on with our expansion and also to make even a stronger tie with the struggling people of the world because they represent two-thirds of the people.
J. Edgar Hoover today characterized the Black Panthers as the most dangerous and violence-prone of all the extremist groups now active in the United States.
There were forces at foot trying to undermine the relationship between not only myself and the leadership of the Black Panther Party, national leadership, but between the various forces within the Black Panther Party who wanted to make the Black Panther Party more responsive and democratic, and those who wanted to maintain the Black Panther Party as an extension of autocratic control of a Central Committee.
The Central Committee of the Black Panther Party, when I come out of jail, I reorganize it again. Huey then was actually opposed to this. I said, no, we have to have a broader Central Committee. Because when I come out of jail, Huey was sitting there with him and David, he went to jail, and Elaine Brown and a couple of other people and said, this is our Central Committee. And I said, Huey, this whole supreme commander crap has got to go. And these are the private conversations I had with Huey, you know. So my point becomes, he was trying to absolutize himself.
We had felt that all the contradiction that was happening between David Hilliard and all the other people in the party and the central leadership and the breakdown in centralism and all of that would be resolved when Huey came home.
When Huey came out, Geronimo remained a member of the Central Committee.
For whatever reason, Huey, after he got out of jail, he wanted to have the total control of the party, but the way the party was set up with the Central Committee, that was impossible. Geronimo, being one of the strongest personalities on the Central Committee, just had to be eliminated. It was around this time that Elmer Geronimo Pratt was captured and branded as a agent by David Hilliard and the Central Committee of the Black Panther Party on the West Coast. Of course, this was a total fabrication. Geronimo was not an agent. In fact, the individual who pointed the finger at Geronimo and declared him an agent, Melvin Cotton Smith, was himself a police informer, an agent, who was assigned to Geronimo by David Hilliard.
A split apparently is open in the leadership of the Black Panther Party. On a San Francisco television talk show, Huey Newton, in the studio, talked with fugitive Aldridge Cleaver, speaking by telephone from Algeria. Cleaver said a purge of Black Panther members is tearing the party apart, blamed it on David Hilliard, and demanded the ouster of Hilliard as Panther Chief of Staff.
Many of those confrontations, both on the West Coast and between the East Coast and the West Coast, happened because because of the COINTELPRO program, what they call Program Brown mail. They would write to one person and sign their letter. They would write to another person and sign each other's person's signature.
And it really cracked the Black Panther Party in two by creating two factions.
All of this was happening at the same time that Huey Newton was planning his itinerary to come back east. And the government used the hysteria and the paranoia around these issues to give Huey the impression that the New York Panthers were unloyal to him.
They wrote to people, in my name, signed my signature. And these were crazy letters that were written by the FBI. And Jeff Ford got a letter from Chairman Fred. Of course, they thought those letters were from each other. And the tone of the letters were incendiary. Well, you're a punk. If I see you, I'm going to, you know, shoot you. You're a coward. If you had guts, you would come down here. I mean, it was literally an attempt by this government to incite violence.
COINTELPRO was the whole cause of the split between the different faction in the party that caused the death of Sam Napier.
In terms of the actual physical integrity and well-being of the Panther, Sam Napier might have been the most important person. The newspaper was the most important entity and tool and institution that the Panthers had. And he was in charge of the paper.
The loss of Sam Napier wasn't just the loss of a person who was a paper salesman. It was like a spirit in the party, a strong, positive spirit that permeated the whole party. You lost a friend, a brother.
Robert Webb was the ranking Panther in the entire East Coast. He had the rank of field marshal, which was a central committee position. It was an underground secret rank.
The police knew who these people were. The police knew that they had orchestrated this conflict, and they gloated over it in their documents when they said that they could take credit for the murder, for Robert Webb's murder, and that they could take credit for the irreconcilable differences in splitting the Black Panther Party. When Huey Newton came to the Northeast, we in New York were responsible for his security. The government knew this through their agents and through the mail that they sent threats, death threats to Huey Newton, purportedly coming from us on the East Coast, saying that, we were faithful to Eldridge Cleaver, and that when Huey came back east, we were going to kill him. And it was up at Yale University that Huey Newton got extremely paranoid. I was told that I was suspended from the Black Panther Party for threatening his life.
So life is very tough, and a funny thing happened to all of us on the way to the grave.
Huey, David sent me underground with Geronimo with no intentions of us being successful, but with the intentions of us eventually being killed. I think their plan was that we would be killed by the police. We would then become martyrs. They would be able to raise us as martyrs and go on with their own program. I followed orders, did what I was supposed to. Geronimo followed orders, did what he was supposed to. And then we end up being in the middle of the split between the Black Panther Party, and they use that as a reason to expel us and to break with Eldridge.
And at the same time that this was going on, the Panther 21 in prison were contemplating writing an open letter criticizing the leadership of the Black Panther Party around various issues.
It was only two things that could happen, that if we could either go to prison or the cemetery. And knowing that people like Twyman Myers and Robert Webb and Sam Napier and Fred Bennett and Fred Hampton had made the ultimate sacrifices, that meant that we could either back up and give up and let them win, or we could struggle against it. On one end, we had the Huey people who were out to do us in, and on the other side, we had the government who was out to kill us. So we were in between the rock and the hard place.
Out of that came the birth of the underground, the Black Liberation Army, the armed wing of the Black Panther Party, whose stated purpose was to start and initiate an offensive military campaign against the forces of reaction.
BLA came into being when those who did political work above ground, when they were more or less from the repressive forces, was forced underground because of their political work in the community. Then they became part of BLA.
So basically it was taking the war to the enemy instead of waiting the enemy to bring the war to you. And that's what the Black Liberation Army was about.
The public at large has a hard time understanding how often innocent people are wrongly convicted.
Los Angeles Police Department, the DA's office, and the FBI were determined that Pratt should stay behind bars. And so they tried to find some other case to bring against him. And they finally decided on an unsolved murder case called the tennis court murder that came out of Santa Monica and charged him with this on the basis of some shenanigans involving a FBI informant named Julius Butler.
Julius Butler said at Pratt's trial he was not an FBI informant. We have a ton of material that clearly indicate that Butler was an FBI informant. As an example, here we have an FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation, August 19, 1969, and all the information he was giving the FBI during that interview.
Of course, the FBI is going to place itself in a position of being able to deny whatever happens, just the way they're denying that Julius Butler was an informant.
Butler said that he has written a letter containing information relating to an involvement of BP members in an affair that could put them in a gas chamber.
I mean, they had an informant file, and Butler was contacted about 36 times, but they said, well, he's not an informant.
Butler said that he was expelled from the BPP in August of 1969. At Pratt's trial, he said he was not expelled, that he quit.
Now, according to FBI's own records, their own telephone tap, they later realized that Geronimo Pratt was in Oakland at the time of the tennis court murder.
The ballistics person came in and testified that the bullet taken from the victim did not match ballistically the barrel of the gun. Well, the way they got around that was they had Julius Butler, as part of his confession, tell the jury that not only did Pratt confess the crime to me, that he did it, but he also told me that he threw the barrel of the gun away. So that took care of that.
The counterintelligence program had successfully divided the Black Panther Party into two opposing groups, and the Newton group had barred any members of its group from having anything to do, speaking on the phone, talking to, and definitely not testifying in trial of the other group. Geronimo Pratt had been expelled. He was in the other group. And so almost all the people who had attended these staff meetings in which he was present, in which I was present, were unable, upon pain of being expelled from the Panther Party, to testify.
This murder in Geronimo's case clearly was not Geronimo. Then those government agents need to be brought to justice. And that's the responsibility of people in this country at this point in time.
The FBI is considering an attempt to try to smash the Black Panther Party. They stopped actually attacking us. Didn't mean they didn't have no covert crap going on.
Infiltration of cocaine into the Black Panther Party, its leadership, Huey P. Newton being the main target.
And every once in a while I say, you, why are you snorting this cocaine? This ain't the thing. Now, I don't say this because I'm trying to destroy Huey's character. What I'm trying to tell people is you have to learn to know the whole truth.
I had clear impression that chemical warfare would be utilized against the Black Panther Party. We had taken a position in our rules against anyone shooting heroin and narcotics found would be immediately dismissed from the Black Panther Party because we essentially were anti-drug in our operations. I'd say, in my analysis and reflection and research, that there were mind control operations run against the Black Panther Party as well as a lot of other operations, psychological warfare programs. And when I say chemical warfare, I'm talking about chemical substances like alcohol and cocaine.
MKUltra was what you might call a research program by the CIA to determine if psychotropic drugs, mind-altering drugs, might be used for intelligence purposes, either for chemical warfare, for the interrogation of intelligence assets, or the neutralization of targets.
See, you have to remember, if you read some of the COINTELPRO documents, they had a psychological profile on Huey, on me, on Eldridge. They knew they could use Huey, and they knew that they could trick Eldridge into a certain level of thinking. So, they had developed this over a period of time. Now, here we got a situation where you got some party members that talk to me that they believe Huey got duped in to, on a small scale level, methodologically destroying the party.
And the party basically went from a people's organization to Huey's private army. That's basically what happened.
It was agreed that I would run for mayor of Oakland, and then Huey insisted that Elaine Brown had to run for city councilwoman at large. We lose the goddamn campaign. And then I found out, late May 1974, that Huey was trying to take over the drug trade in Oakland, California. Jesse Huey, the party is over.
The committee will resolve itself into executive session. The room will be cleared and swept.
No director of the National Security Agency has ever before been required by Congress to testify in open session.
There is a great deal about the best intelligence service in the world that we would be proud to tell, to bring into perspective what we have had to say recently about the missteps or misdeeds of the past.
I believe that I could go back over my experiences in the Justice Department and find some areas in which the Bureau is not fully accountable to me. Yes, Senator.
William C. Sullivan retired as the FBI's chief investigator 6 years ago after a falling out with J. Edgar Hoover, was killed in a deer hunting accident in New Hampshire today. Sullivan was 65.
Bill Sullivan, who was the number three man in the Bureau in charge of Division 5 Domestic Intelligence, expressed extreme remorse to me about his role in suggesting an anonymous letter to Martin Luther King for Dr. King to commit suicide a week before he was going to be called upon to testify before the House Committee on Assassinations. He was out in a pasture near his New Hampshire home. And he was mistaken, supposedly, for a deer by a young man out hunting, and was killed.
I understand from the news media that the son was an experienced hunter, and I don't know how an experienced hunter could mistake a man who's dressed in a red plaid jacket for the head of a deer. I mean, I have never seen a red deer. You know, maybe they're out there somewhere.
But if I could get a virtuous woman,
who's the boss?
Well, in a human society, there aren't really any bosses. But who is the real leader, and who is the person whose words are most meaningful to the party as a whole? There isn't any question about it. I mean, it always, that's Huey is that person.
I had the distinct impression consistently from 1971 that Ms. Elaine Brown was a highly placed intelligence operative inside the Black Panther Party.
I think Elaine Brown came in through Earl Anthony, and she followed the same course of devious type of activities. So I'm saying all this to say that they got involved with people and caused a lot of problems, but we was aware of it. We just wasn't aware of the extent that the LAPD, the federal government with its COINTEL, the CIA, FBI, we wasn't aware of to the extent that these people were involved.
She acknowledges in her own words, in her book, Taste of Power, that in fact she had been educated, groomed, taught at the hands of a longtime Central Intelligence Agency operative, J. Richard Kennedy, who anyone can find out about in David Garrow's book, the FBI and Dr. Martin Luther King.
So many party members literally have told me they believe this, that this woman was connected some kind of way and got step by step, piece by piece, got Huey hooked over into some notion that he could get more money behind the scene if he step by step, methodologically, demised the Black Panther Party.
We've always wanted to represent the will of the people. They're not interested in socialism at this time because they believe that they can get their just desserts in this capitalist system. When the people democratically want a change in system to a socialist system, then the party will be the first to have solidarity.
John Stockwell, former station chief of the CIA in Angola, he said, well, I want to say this to you very clear. The Huey P. Newton that people see today is a direct result of operations run by the Central Intelligence Agency to ensure that he will turn out the way that he is.
Some people have a distorted view of me, and it gives me very much trouble. It adds to the sort of timid personality that I already have. It makes me uncomfortable because I know that I can't give them all of those things that their idol is supposed to. And I don't want to appear to them a fake, but I would just like to tell them that, you know, I'm just another regular human being.
Huey P. Newton was never the same. He eventually became Dr. Huey P. Newton, PhD. He eventually became a crackhead, and he eventually was assassinated in Oakland in 1989. In the course of our journey, we discovered that certain individuals involved in the demise of the Black Panther Party were also the same individuals who were involved in the demise of the American Indian Movement.
It began in 1973 after the Church Committee hearings when they proclaimed that they were never going to execute covert operations against dissenting organizations. Yet, at the very time they were conducting such an operation against the American Indian Movement, a program directed towards the American Indian Movement very similar to the program directed against the Black Panther Party.
The same bag of tricks in each case. You have a very concerted disinformation campaign. You have the insertion of infiltrators and the development of informants. The use of the infiltrators as provocateurs, attempting to convert bona fide activists into provocateurs or disruptive elements within their own organization. They literally would unleash death squads to make sure that the people who were living on the $1,200 a year in the tar paper shack would continue to live on the $1,200 in the tar paper shack.
One of the personnel who were involved in persecuting and later framing Geronimo Pratt was also involved in the fabrication of evidence to convict Leonard Peltier. This was an FBI agent by the name of Richard W. Held.
Well, Richard the Elder, which is Richard G. Held, was basically one of the architects of COINTELPRO.
Strangely enough, both the father and son were involved in the operation on Pine Ridge, which led to the frame-up of Leonard Peltier on murder charges.
Basically, the paramilitary operations of 250 to 300 FBI agents, SWAT personnel, on the reservation for about a three-month period of time to once and for all break the back of the American Indian Movement.
Armored personnel carriers with heavy machine guns, M-16s wearing camouflage uniforms, overflights by Phantom F-4 reconnaissance jets and Huey helicopters, and remote sensing devices. It was very much like what was deployed in Vietnam at that time.
When the people went into Wounded Knee, there were chiefs and elders and some of the American Indian Movement members. These were the Ogallala people. They didn't have any weapons. They went in there peacefully. They were surrounded with machine guns, armored personnel carriers, so the people picked up arms. And, you know, there were no comparison what the government had. We shot back. It was self-defense.
the government spent nearly $1 billion in the military operation on Pine Ridge. And that's $1 billion in 1975 or 1973 dollars. That's probably more than all the money invested in social programs on that reservation from 1870 onward. A people's movement to control the resources and land on the reservations happened to coincide with the energy crisis in the Black Hills. There were at least a dozen large multinational corporations, energy corporations involved. And the government purports to represent the people, but it really represents vested economic interests. The movements that are working for positive social change threaten the interests of the transnational corporations, and the government is essentially an instrument of corporate policy.
Peltier is a prisoner of the longest war in the history of the United States. That's the war against the indigenous people of the United States.
And he didn't shoot anybody, and he didn't kill anybody, yet he was convicted because two FBI agents had been killed, and somebody had to pay.
The question then becomes, what is he in that cage for? And the answer is to serve as an example. An example of the arbitrary ability of the government of the United States to repress the legitimate aspirations for liberation of Native people, all Native people. He serves that purpose. So long as he's there, even though it's known that he's not guilty of the specific offense which he was convicted.
He's been sentenced to two life sentences. But finally they admitted in the last argument of the case in November of 1992, and that they didn't know who shot the two FBI agents. They said it several times in different ways without any ambiguity. We don't know who killed the agents. We don't know who fired the fatal shots. And yet here's Leonard Peltier serving these sentences. We're addressing President Clinton to give clemency to Leonard Peltier in the name of simple justice. Now.
Army, of course, has its contingency plans for putting down civil disturbance in the United States. They had these programs in the 1960s called Cable Splicer and Garden Plot for entering onto the scene in the event of civil disturbance in the United States. These activities continued on into the 1980s, but the main agency that became involved in the on the civilian side was FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
The FEMA has created a great deal of paranoia, probably for very good reason. Their whole reason for existence is to take control and keep things going in time of a crisis of, you know, earthquake or military crisis. And in the instance of a military or political crisis, we don't know what extremes are willing to go. to. They have, they've drawn up their martial law plans.
One of the things that that grew out of the military contingency planning, such as cable splicer and garden plot, was the military assistance to the police forces in organizing these and training these SWAT squads. So these are, in fact, outright militarized police units, even though they are civilian. And the United States military, the Army particularly, had much to do with the establishment of these units through the 1960s and into the 70s. Now, I think all the way across the country, there are SWAT units everywhere. And they started out in places like Chicago, I believe, and Los Angeles. But they were done with the help of the U.S. military.
Well, Rex 84 was a plan to draw up to collect dissidents around the country who might be involved in violent activity and throw them basically in detainment camps. Some people call them concentration camps.
They had, I believe, something like 17 military installations selected in the United States where they would house up to, I believe, something like a 150,000 or 250,000 people in the event that the streets turned to chaos if Reagan had invaded Central America in the early 1980s.
So despite what the director of FBI, the FBI may be saying currently, you can assume that they're still conducting covert operations.
They were going to round up every dissident and every person who took to the street, plus a lot of foreigners, at the same time, because they did not want to have the situation develop as it had against Johnson and Nixon over the Vietnam War. So in the early 80s, Reagan said all he had to do, it was all prepared, the statement declaring martial law, suspending the Constitution, and then they could go out and take everybody over to these military reservations, the equivalent of concentration camps, and just hold them there until what he wanted to do was done.
The government is definitely shifting intelligence resources to the private sector. And one of the reasons for this is to escape public scrutiny under laws such as the Freedom of Information Act. Freedom of Information Act only applies to government agencies.
You have to imagine technology 20, 30 years in advance of what we're using today. All that is classified, and it's classified for a very good reason, because it's being put to criminal uses.
Bugging and interception of private communication, the disappearance of privacy, you might say. What's going on now is that there are large private corporate databases accumulated that accumulate information on individuals, track their activities, track their economic activities. These corporations, we call themselves credit corporations or whatever, but they're essentially intelligence operations.
Please listen, my brother and my sister too. Although these lies may not apply to you, we need less killing, less killing, more chilling. To reach the pinnacle, my mind is willing. Less drinking, more thinking. What's the hell is shocking? My mind's body, spirit, what's the hell is shocking? I mean to suggest, what's the hell is shocking? We can live a little better, I do profess. You see the soul, he leads to the bottle to the joint. It's a drama, no effect, just to get my point. The joint, to the coke, the coke, to the dope. And you know what? The wake up, either dead or broke.
If the ultimate weapon is a major subsidy, we will use it. It is worth it. It's worth $50 million this year, if that's what it costs to buy a $3 million crop. If it'll do the job. Now, it may be there'll be social problems and the political problems and the rest, and their embarrassment, but it won't do the job. My guess is that $50 million wouldn't do it, but it is worth it to this country. If that will do the job, pay $50 million.
How it is that the United States, with all its military services, the Coast Guard, the CIA, the FBI, the DEA, and cooperating agencies, including local police departments, how they are not able to suppress the drug trade in the United States, how they cannot seal the borders and stop these shipments coming in, and then the whole distribution system.
The nature of the drug use and of availability of drugs began to change as the Vietnam War went bad. Specifically, there was a shift from the availability of relatively innocuous drugs like marijuana and hashish on the street to those drugs becoming relatively scarce through the federal drug programs, and they're appearing instead a large quantity of a very pure, very cheap heroin.
DEA, FBI, CIA, military, they're all into this international narcotics trafficking. So it doesn't mean that any particular target is only the area of one intelligence agency, because there are all kinds of interagency working groups in which they coordinate their activities directed toward a single target.
The drug trade always supports the government's internal political agenda. It has never not supported the government's internal political agenda. For an example, the phenomena that we saw with the Nicaraguan situation, which we call the Iran-Contra affair, Iran had less to do with the Iran-Contra affair, in our opinion, than Colombia, because it was the Colombian drug pushers which opened up avenues for finance that the United States government could not get legally from the Congress.
Some of the Hmong tribes people were involved in the production of poppies, and under the CIA, the production greatly increased, and the revenues from the sale of those drugs, which were flown out by CIA proprietary airlines, were used to further finance covert operations by the CIA.
So what the United States government did was to get the ready cash through Elliott Abrams that allowed drugs, cocaine, to come into these poor communities all over the country as a means to then serve the secondary agenda, which is to sedate and control and criminalize as many of those black and Latin people that they can.
One of the effects is to take totally out of the political picture a whole generation or two of young black males who either get involved in the drug trade and end up in prison, or who get involved in consumption and do not get involved in politics. It's the state that builds the archipelago of prisons. It's the state that invents a rhetoric of three strikes and you're out. It's the state that invents a vocabulary that is soaked in crime, which is meant to describe the lives of young people. Adolescence, basically.
I've spent 19 years in prison in the United States for my political beliefs. You were the symbol that helped sustain me and other African-American political prisoners. We love you, and we will not give up the fight. We will not give up the fight. We will not give up the fight. We will not give up the fight.
I think we've had a political prisoner.
Welcome, and that was a selection of audio files on the history of the counterintelligence program in the United States, a program which set out to destroy and decimate the black liberation movement in the U.S. And that's going to conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Wednesday, October 28th, 2024. And we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special edition of our program. And if you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast, go to the Pan-African Radio Network. You can reach the Pan-African Radio Network at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com.
We'll close out with the music of Clifford Brown and Max Roach from the 1954 album, Pure Genius. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful, beautiful week. Thank you.
Thank you.